Traditions. If we stop to count in this fall season, we find a number of traditions around us. The harvest is celebrated worldwide and throughout antiquity. In the United States, we celebrate Thanksgiving. And last month, we sent the kids out for Halloween trick-or-treating. Next month, most Christians and many non-Christians will gather to celebrate Christmas, and some, the older traditions of solstice. Well, it seems a fitting time to pause and take a look at customs here and elsewhere and of all sorts, from the clothes we wear to the way we worship and what we celebrate, and to ask a few questions. For example, are our customs or those of other peoples what they seem? And if it's customary and traditional, does custom and tradition necessarily imply any sort of historical accuracy? I'm Susan McInnes. Today on Conversations, Costumes and Customs, we'll spend an hour with anthropologists Phyllis Morrow and Chase Hensel. Dr. Morrow is assistant professor of anthropology and assistant professor of cross-cultural communications at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Chase Hensel is in the PhD program at the University of California at Berkeley. Among other interests, both have focused their studies on the Yupik culture of Alaska. Welcome and thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Phyllis, when we first started talking about this program, you brought up the subject of neckties. You said to me, well, look, a necktie was once a cravat, but just because a necktie was once a cravat, does it necessarily mean it's a cravat today? Why don't we start there? Is it? Was it?
Well, without getting into the specific history and evolution of the necktie, which I don't think we want to go into in detail, I think that the point is that the customs that we have today refer to tradition and are often validated by our sense that they're historic or historically accurate. But in fact, that's a way of imbuing them with meaning, but not necessarily a truth in the historical sense. And we can trace the history of the necktie, but we can also see that there are differences in meaning, in symbolic meaning, between the necktie of today and the cravat of yesterday, just as, you know, it's thought, for example, that the handshake was originally a way of showing that one was unarmed. Today, a handshake is a greeting, and we no longer think about the fact that the person is showing us that she's not carrying a switchblade or a handgun.
Although it does imply, if I extend my hand to you, that I'm probably not going to hurt you.
That's right.
We may not think that, but the implication is there.
So that there is a thread of meaning which carries through, which provides continuity. And it's, of course, interesting to find out what the history is, and sometimes that history is inherent in the word or the object itself. I think of the Yupik example, since you mentioned our interest in Yupik culture. When you greet someone, when they come into your home and you want them to be comfortable, you say matachten. What it means today is take off your coat. Literally, it means take off your clothes. Now, that probably resonates with a time when people entered the qazgik, the men's house. One had very little under one's parka. One was not entirely naked, obviously, but the idea was that when one removed one's parka, one was really making oneself vulnerable in the same way that a handshake to show that you're not carrying a weapon is expressing your openness, your vulnerability, and your trust. So when one says matachten today, people don't think of its literal meaning. They think of take off your coat. But it has that historical resonance.
Chase, another example that you and I talked about when we talked was doffing your hat, something that gentlemen once did when greeting a lady. And that has a long history.
Right, and frankly, I have to say that the sources from which I've heard that history aren't necessarily historically reliable, but the history that I've heard for that is that those relate to European traditions, sort of post-Roman, of stripping prisoners naked and taking them before the king or queen or duke or whoever was ruling to see what was going to happen to them. So that previous meaning of I'm your captive and I'm symbolically naked before you has now changed to where, so it's saying I'm powerless before you. It was saying I'm powerless before you. And now it's actually that usage of a gentleman tipping his hat to a lady is, I think, more the person with power symbolically gesturing to, but not lessening their power, still remaining in control.
So there's almost a reversal in that one.
Yeah,
I would say so. What we think of as the post-feminist movement, one no longer tips one's hat, although one may nod to say hello. So maybe it rolls all the way back through history and draws some of the humbling of oneself forward, whether it's actual or perceived.
Right, and I think the nod still is a, you know, lowering the gaze, which you see a lot in, I mean, not to get into sociobiology, but you do see a lot of animal sorts of things of the superior head position, like between two dogs, versus the one whose head is down or whose neck is bared.
So, or rolls on his back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, headgear as a sign of status, rank, is very universal. So the king's crown, you know, one doffs one's hat before the king.
And it's amazing to see movies
God.
From the 50s where all the men are wearing hats. You know, I mean, we don't are particular kinds of hats, like you see a scene in New York or a scene in London, and almost all of the men in that, you know, urban commercial setting will be wearing the same kind of hat, you know, making the same kind of statement. So that, in fact, it's very recently that usage of male headgear has sort of fallen out of fashion, if I can.
Well, we've looked at clothing. What else stands out for either of you as customs we honor, which may not be the same as they were in antiquity, but which we suppose to be the same?
There's a very nice article in a collection called The Invention of Tradition about the use of Highland Scottish costumes. And the idea, I think we're branching out here into some wider symbolism of clothing and the manipulation of what that those symbols mean. But what we associate with the classic Scottish Highlander, the kilt and the bagpipe and the tartan plaid, are in fact a recent historical invention, which happened in several phases apparently, but it does not resemble the original Scottish Highlander garb very much. Although tartans were worn, they were sort of camouflaged to the heather. They were browns and so on, and
they weren't they didn't identify you by family at all. There was no
clan identification with a tartan, but the construction of Highland culture after the British actually suppressed Highland culture. It was resurrected by the upper classes, and the interesting development of the kilt was of an English Quaker industrialist, an iron worker, who thought that the costumes that were worn by the workers were a little bit awkward in the ironworks. So he modified them.
One gets an impression they were almost sort of toga-like. I mean, they were kind of
wrapped up in
one long draped piece of cloth.
So what he did was he separated the upper drape from the lower drape and had, you know, the seamstresses sew pleats into the lower ones and there and made it shorter, and there came the kilt. And then the kilt became suppressed at some point when the English were trying to quell rebellion in the Highlands. And during that period, although that kilt had been associated with the workers, it was the upper-class Highlanders who started wearing the kilts sort of in the privacy of their own homes as a symbol of identification with that actual constructed cultural symbol, you know. And
so its meaning changed. And then
the
meaning of the tartans. Oh, go ahead.
You go ahead with the tartans.
Do you remember who it was? The Prince of Wales? I can't remember. There was some British monarch who was coming for a ceremonial visit, and various groups. There was a big cloth wholesaler in Edinburgh had orders for kilts for various groups. I mean, there was some idea of dressing all the members of your clan in one color, but
there was a wide variety of choices that one could make at that time. There wasn't any that were assigned to a particular clan.
Then, as people were rushing to try to get ready for this royal entourage to arrive, various other groups who'd never had no sense of, okay,
the McPhersons.
We're the McPhersons. What's our clan tartan? So they asked the wholesalers, okay, you know, so we need a bunch of our clan tartan made up into kilts. And at later stages in things got so hurried that they were just taking whatever bolts of cloth they had, and they're saying, okay, the McPhersons, we've got 20 bolts of this and an order for 19. So this is what the McPhersons historic clan tartan is. And so now those have all been reified. There may be Scots in the audience who will be very offended at this. I mean, this is their tradition. But, you know, as an anthropologist, you have to also say, well, yes, it is your tradition and it's very meaningful to you, but it's historical. It's historical meaning, which gives it authenticity, although that's the kind of thing that we hold on to and think gives it authenticity. It's the fact of what it means to people. It's effective meaning.
But it's the fact that we can, we give it authenticity by saying that it's historically accurate and has a long time depth. And it's very interesting because if you look at what's going on worldwide, and we can bring this around to Alaska in a bit, you have situations where, for example, the governments of countries or the ruling elites or the urban elite try to structure a cultural identity with symbols that they connect with the history of the people.
Particularly the pre-colonial history.
History of the people.
For a lot of the world, including America, you know, people are grasping for some kind of authentic history which wasn't given to them by whatever colonial power controlled the country. Sorry.
So there's actually a dual movement here. One is people trying to assert their identity in terms of symbols of their own, which are validated by history and repetition and so on. And there's also the possibility and the actuality in some places of governmental groups imposing symbols to create a post-colonial identity. And, you know, whether I'm not saying that this is a conspiracy on this part, on their part or anything, but it does construct a sense of a culture that is, in fact, a recent construction.
But almost always the rationale is given that this is the historic construction. So the recency of it is people usually try to hide that. I mean, we were discussing witch rituals, if we can get into that, the other day, and how the study was of witches in an urban setting in London. And even though a lot of times the person who was in charge of a ritual had, in fact, written it the night before, 2 days before, cobbled it together from various rituals of other cultures and their dreams, insights, readings, it was always presented as if it had historic resonance, that this was, you know, even if its newness might be acknowledged in that it was newly discovered or brought back in. But we seem to really, as humans, really cling to that validation of history.
The woman who was studying the witches, name's Luhmann?
Lerman.
Lerman, sorry. Said that the newly constructed rituals came about in part because there isn't a historical record going back to the early witches. Is that
right? You know, before I read this, thought that, you know, that current witchcraft was based, at least ideas of witchcraft were based on some historical survivals. But in fact, it's a 19th century construction, late 19th century construction, which even then people were justifying that, oh yes, in fact, this was found by, you know, I was in the countryside and the last surviving witch, you know, passed these secrets on to me. But in fact, none of it bears very close scrutiny. And so, but now those traditions, I mean, that's close to 100 years ago. So what we think of as historical...
is 100 years old, but it's not from the year 1600
right,
when we
right.
think of and many witches.
Can you give some examples of those customs, quote-unquote customs?
Well, a lot of the... the other thing that went on is the only historical sources that they were primarily from witch trials. And clearly... with a lot of French Inquisition trials, the priests were most concerned about reversal rituals, things where Christian rituals were done backwards, were done with things sort of an inversion, things substituted for the host or for the wine.
Where you take something that has normally a very profane meaning and you treat it as a sacred object in the context of the reversal.
And so, I mean, there are some echoes of that in modern ritual. I'm trying to think. Nothing immediately pops out from allurement. I guess just the sense that there were Celtic rituals and covens and all of this is mostly a 19th century construction. And now it's being I'm not sure how active it is in Fairbanks, but certainly in other parts of the country, there are a lot of women who are very interested in the idea of the goddess of pre-Christian, male gods and this sort of father and son worship, but of the mother goddess. And so some of those 19th century and early 20th century writings are being reinterpreted to pull out figures of women. And also women talk about, who identify themselves as feminist witches, talk about seizing her story out of this history, which is his story.
Does the author think, or do you think from your study of this, that whether or not it's historically accurate, it is filling a gap that is present in the current culture so that we reach back into our conception of history, our conception of past traditions, to bring forth the things that will resolve emptiness in our own culture from our perspective? Or is that too simplistic a thought?
Well, certainly to validate our beliefs, to find meaning, they're fairly classic studies of ritual. A man named Max Gluckman talked about ritual in terms of something that papers over the cracks in society. That is, that helps integrate on a symbolic level areas that may be contradictory in our belief, in our social groups, which often have conflicting beliefs and conflicting ideologies and practices, that ritual, one of the functions of ritual is that it helps to paper those cracks over. So, yes, we look back for that. And it's I think that we have to be very careful when we're talking about this to say that people are going back and looking for a different emphasis in writings of the past or in oral history is not to say that that's bad, incorrect, or wrong in some way. It's to say that people are doing it for a reason, as you point out. I mean, they're looking for that kind of validation. We need that. If we don't have a sense of history, then we kind of see ourselves as lost. And whether that sense of history can be traced accurately back to the roots to which we think it can be traced or not is somewhat beside the point.
If it sustains us, if it provides us with a way of getting on with our lives and making our lives meaningful, then on one level that's more the point.
And people have always sustained themselves by a sense of repetition and renewal, and that's what ritual brings out. I mean, you talked about Thanksgiving and harvest rituals and so on. Those celebrate a cycling in the seasons, in our activities in relation to the seasons, the idea that the earth renews itself, that our crops grow each year and we harvest them each year and so on. That is reassuring. And it's particularly reassuring because our modern age is one where we emphasize and are constantly aware of change and innovation. So it's not surprising that particularly now we're both interested in, and perhaps we more than ever, are reconstructing our past to give us that sense of continuity that otherwise we don't see in our lives.
Let me pause for a moment and tell listeners that they're listening to Conversations on KUAC-FM. I'm Susan McInnes. With me today are anthropologists Chase Hensel, who is a graduate student in the PhD program at the University of California, Berkeley, focusing on an aspect of the Yupik culture, but very interested in the broad umbrella of anthropology. Also with us, Dr. Phyllis Morrow, who is an assistant professor here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks of anthropology and of cross-cultural communication. And today, we're talking about costumes and customs, things that change and things that remain the same, and some things that remain the same but actually are changed. You, Phyllis, brought up once or twice in this discussion, the concept of invented tradition. And the other day when you and I were talking, Chase, you talked about the fact that we tend to feel kind of moreless in this society because we're changing so very fast. But in fact, the concept of invented tradition says that most traditions around us are invented because of the times change. Can the two of you give some thought to that?
I wouldn't say that most of the traditions around us are invented. They're certainly not invented out of whole cloth. I think that's the point we're making. But let's talk. Some people make a distinction which might be useful right now between custom and tradition. And we could talk about traditions as being fixed and unchanging, such as a priest always wears a cassock, okay? That there's a certain order to a Passover Seder. It means order, and that's always that way. That's a tradition. Customs are changing to a certain extent. That is, they are responsive to new situations. They both allow people to extend the meaning of other situations to reinterpret or to interpret something startling and new that happens within a group. And they are... they also have a sense of continuity. So if we look at culture as a continuing process of always making itself, essentially, or we're always making it, then we can see that we are using both traditions and customs. When we talk about invented traditions, we're talking about fossilizing customs in a lot of cases. Well, let's take a very topical example, which is in Alaska, you hear the phrase customary and traditional all the time. Native people have to justify their use of subsistence resources and so on, and their way of hunting by not just in terms of hunting, but in terms of sea mammal products used in artwork or whatever, in terms of customary and traditional use. Now...
and in fact, for instance, it was made illegal to hunt sea otters, I think, in 1911, and there was at least one case brought by Fish and Wildlife where they said that a native person who had killed a sea otter, that was illegal because it wasn't customary and traditional, since no one had been able to legally kill sea otters, you know, until the popular, because there weren't any around to kill, for one thing. So obviously that can't be traditional if you weren't doing it.
It's impossible, looking at cultures as an anthropologist, to pick a particular date and say, prior to this time, what people did was customary and traditional, and what they did after that date is no longer customary and traditional. Because customs, as I said, are flexible to a degree. So, for example, if one... I think my favorite example is the incident that occurred in a village, a Yupik village, some years ago, where... muskox don't usually come into the village or in the area of this particular village. Muskox were not in season, and a muskox wandered into the area. A couple of young men were out hunting, and they saw the muskox, and they weren't sure what to do. Within their own custom, if an animal presented itself, it was to be taken, because the animal was offering itself, and that was essentially fair game, and to use the English term for that. And... yet they knew that it was illegal to shoot the muskox. So they went to the elders of the village, and they said, what should we do? And the elders said, you should shoot it. So they went back out.
You shouldn't
out.
Waste it. It's
you
offering
shouldn't
itself.
Waste it. So they went out, and they shot it, and they were brought to trial.
Well, they brought it back, and it was divided up among people.
It was used according to customary fashion. What happened in that case was that there was an anomalous situation. They went to the arbiters of tradition, of custom, in their own village, and they said, the way we would deal with this is that we take the principle and we apply it to the new situation, the principle that you take the game that's offered.
That's custom.
Right.
Right.
Then they go to court. They got turned in. It went to trial. The argument from the viewpoint of the legal system is that traditions are unchanging. Okay, custom and tradition are used synonymously by the... the Western legal
although
system.
The illustration divides them up perfectly.
Although the illustration divides them up well.
Right.
The legal viewpoint was that they had no right to take this animal because there was no customary and traditional
use
of muskox there. In fact, they were fined. So we get into some very sticky situations here. Just at the time in history when anthropologists are looking at custom as being less hide-bound than they used to, as is very common, the sort of prevailing popular definitions are lagging behind. And what's being imposed, I'm not saying this is all due to anthropologists and their definitions, but the popular view lags behind the specialist's view here. And the idea of custom and tradition as being very rigid is being imposed on Native peoples in Alaska today, as we find elsewhere in the world. It's not just here.
I was going to jump back to something that I was going to say earlier when you asked the question about people inventing traditions to meet needs in their lives. One of the things that I found really interesting about Tanya Luhrmann's book, The Persuasions of the Witch's Craft, was that the if you were going to profile what your average urban witch was that she studied in London, it was a college-educated computer programmer, computer operator. And so, I mean, it wasn't some farmer. It wasn't some, you know, it was somebody engaged in a particular kind of highly intellectual and abstracted work.
And also modern.
And very modern.
On the edge of something that is constantly changing.
Yeah.
So that person, a woman.
Or a man.
Or a man.
Actually, it was male. It was more likely male than female.
It's reaching back into as far back as he or she can go to find a root.
Yeah. Well, and is reaching, you know, is in this occupation which relies strictly on logic, on a particular kind of logic, and is reaching, is trying to maybe to develop some other side of themselves or of their consciousness. So,
this, I'm not sure whether it exactly relates or it may be a left-hand turn, but can we talk to about upheaval for a moment? The Native Alaskan cultures of this country have gone through, are going through an upheaval by the force of a dominant culture kind of coming in and imposing its customs and traditions. Earlier, you were talking about
defining its customs and traditions.
Defining, all right. Yes. You spoke earlier about, say, a government imposing traditions, and it made me think of Nazi Germany when a government came in and said the symbol will be the swastika and the power will be in the black uniforms of the SS and the brown of the brown shirts, and there will be youth groups now that are mobilized under Hitler rather than the earlier youth groups that were. And then another spin-off of that is Mao's Cultural Revolution and his walk across China, whereupon he, in walking across China with 10,000 and growing troops, changed the face of a nation. So I wanted to ask the two of you to look at upheavals and those customs and traditions which change as a culture moves across a land.
Well, now, interestingly, both of those were certainly justified in terms of historical traditions which were being returned to, you know, by Mao, to return to the purity of the revolution.
They were extreme cases of invented tradition.
They were extreme cases of invented tradition, but still using this sort of past grab bag of cultural symbols to justify their imposition. That it wasn't, I mean, it's like, it seems like as humans, on the one hand, we need to invent, and on the other hand, we need to cover up the fact of our inventing in the very instant that it happens.
I think in terms of Native American traditions and upheavals, these kinds of symbolic changes are happening in a very complex dialogue. We don't have the situation that we had in Nazi Germany where someone is saying, these are your traditions, you know, and this is our new state. But we do have a combination of a loss of tradition in many cases and a recording of tradition by outsiders to which people from those traditions go, you know, consult ethnographies or whatever that were written much earlier by outside observers. to reclaim their tradition. And we have a sense of culture as being most embodied in the performative, in dances and songs and stories, narratives, those sorts of obvious visual, visible and audible manifestations of cultural tradition. So what happens is that in creating symbols for themselves, Native Americans may choose those situations which bring out the performative, so that we have powwows. We had the American Indian Dance Theater here, which was a very good example of some traditions that are, in a sense, invented traditions. They're taken from specific American Indian traditions, but they've become broader than any one particular group, and are shared now as important manifestations of culture. And they become symbols for that kind of unity and rebellion that you're talking about. But it gets very complicated because, on the one hand, this definition of culture as the performative is really imposed. I mean, that's a museum definition of culture in a sense, which comes from people who are outside the culture. People inside a culture live their culture, and the culture is in everything. It's in the way I'm talking now. It's in this interview. It's in this the way this studio is set up. It's in the fact that people are listening on a radio. That's all culture, not just the fact that I'm, you know, telling something, performing something. I'm not really performing this because it's non-rehearsed, but, you know, if I were singing a song, for example, that's just one part of culture. It's just something that seems to be very easily grasped by people as being cultural.
So I wonder, the question, it's probably the question of the century, is what happens to a people when the culture is held in the performative rather than in the daily rituals and habits of 18,000 years?
Well, you're right that it's the question of the century. I think, fortunately, what we're pointing to with this whole discussion is that people are extremely inventive. And that, I mean, being somewhat of an eternal optimist, I see a tremendous amount of diversity still in the world, and I'm hoping that that will stay despite the globalization of so much of our Western culture.
And sometimes, you know, to some extent, that diversity becomes more covert, less overt with time, so that if someone is bilingual, you may not realize that they speak another language. This whole aspect of their life and their culture may be lost on you. If you never eat with them, you may have no idea, you know, what if they're eating foods traditional of their culture. Or even if you do eat with them, they may very well not choose to cook things that are highly ethnically marked because you might not like them. So you could have steak and potatoes with them or whatever and think that they were just like you, when in fact there's a lot of diversity being not covered, sometimes it can be intentionally covered up, but other times it's covered up by someone wanting to make you feel comfortable, not wanting to may have you feel a difference, so you miss that difference.
We're talking today on Conversations with Chase Hensel and with Phyllis Morrow, and our conversation is titled today, Changing Costumes and Changing Customs. As we've been talking, I've been wondering about the phenomena of the football game. This may sound like a silly left-handed turn, but in this country in the past 20 years, we have become culturally turned towards the game of football. Now, if you turn on a television on Monday night, you get Monday Night Football, and there is the tradition of the Super Bowl, just like there's a tradition of the World Series. I suppose I wonder if it says something about our culture that you spoke earlier about cultural identity and bonding. Do you suppose we're creating a cultural identity by creating a tradition around sports?
Well, let's back up for a second. I mean, certainly some of what's going on, some of the issues that are big in our culture, particularly for males, are status. You know, who's more powerful, who makes more money, who's sexier, who's more successful. And so, you know, a lot of those issues are played out in a very violent fashion.
Also, who's bigger and has broader shoulders.
Right.
Tougher.
tougher.
Yeah. And who wins in this culture, too?
Who wins and who loses?
And so do you suppose if we can't necessarily, all of us, win in the business world or the sports world or the social world personally, if we're not the biggest, toughest, handsomest, whatever, we can win because our team wins on Monday night?
Yeah, we can certainly identify with it.
Is there some of that?
We can certainly identify with it, and we can look at the football game as being a playing out of a lot of our cultural values. There's a wonderful article by an anthropologist named Clifford Geertz about the cockfight in Indonesia, where he analyzes what goes on in the cockfight. And this is very analogous to football, because in the cockfight, and I have to say that the double meaning is true in the language
in
Bali,
well.
Too. Men play out their masculinity through the roosters that are fighting against each other.
To the death.
To the death.
And so in this society in which there's a tremendous emphasis on everything going smoothly and no kind of clear, never butting up clearly against status distinctions or whatever, against this you have the cockfight where, you know, the winner is crowing and carrying on, and the loser is dead. You know, I mean, it's just blood and gore right there. And so, you know, momentarily, one man is this complete victor.
Triumph.
Yeah, triumph. And the other one is completely crushed. And certainly the Balinese themselves, in Geertz's.
And we can see the football game as expressing cultural values and male aggression and so on as well. But it's, of course, more than male aggression. I mean, we have the cheerleaders out there.
Do we certainly have sex getting in there? And
female. And if you look at the American Thanksgiving, it's very typical, and I suppose this is so obvious to most of our listeners, it probably is not worth stating, but it's a very common new tradition in America for the men to sit in one room and watch the games on Thanksgiving Day, and for the women to be off in the kitchen. That in itself, as an invented tradition, as it were, expresses role distinctions in our society, and it reemphasizes the importance of the football game as a male symbol.
How cheerful. What else? We're in the fall season, and we began this show by thinking aloud, at least, about the things which proceed from October on, Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas. Would you like to take on any of those to take a look at how we look at them and how they are? We're going to start with Halloween. Halloween has this kind of gentle gaiety about it. Kids get dressed up as someone else, a spook or a ninja turtle, whatever those are, and goes off and collects candy with other friends and parents hovering in the background. There is a whole school of thought in this country, a religious school of thought, a fundamental thinking, that says this should not be happening in this culture at this time because of the satanic roots of the Halloween tradition.
Well, I think we are back to the necktie question.
Sure. Is a necktie a cravat?
Right. Halloween today, as it is practiced by children going from door to door, is as far from satanic as anything I can think of. And I'm sorry if I'm offending some people by saying that, but I think it's very true. Halloween does have, still carries a sense of being a ritual of reversal. That is, a time when normal behavior is turned upside down, and one is allowed, has a certain freedom to do things that one would not ordinarily do. For example, if we were to dress up as monsters and ghosts,
and go to house demanding
food.
Food. I mean, that
it's a suspension of the normal rules of behavior, and it is both a release, and in that way, and a delight, especially to children, and it also, by its very reversal, states what our norms are. You know, I mean, we know that this is a suspension of normal activity. Rituals of reversal are found all over the world. Carnival is a great example. The New Orleans Mardi Gras and the carnival that's found all through Central America, those are rituals of reversal, and they can get very extreme. There's usually a lot of drinking, a lot of sexualization of activity, and wild, dramatic costumes. Halloween is a very tame sort of ritual of reversal, and it has other aspects, too. I mean, I'm very aware when we go from house to house on Halloween that we're creating some solidarity with our neighbors that ordinarily we don't have. I mean, we are new in a neighborhood, and we would not normally knock on the doors of our neighbors and say good evening to them and laugh and, you know, get food from them and so on. But having done that, you know, that has changed our relationship with them for the rest of the year. It's something that carries over into your ordinary activities as well.
And also in that way we various people whose children our children know, but whom we've never met, you know, we sort of meet for the first time. So it has another social function as well.
Which in our society where neighbors tend to be much more separate, especially well, they may be more separate than they would be in a small village where they're all related. It serves some function of creating a sense of neighborhood.
Which is an interesting thing, since 30 years ago, neighborhoods were neighborhoods.
That's right.
We all knew our neighborhood, mm-hmm. and our neighbors all knew us. So Halloween in 1990 is fulfilling a function now of reestablishing that mm-hmm. knit between homes, houses, and families.
I think so.
What about Thanksgiving? Anything that we do that we think is traditional besides moving from the TV room to the kitchen?
I always think about Thanksgiving and Thanksgiving dinners. We once had a Thanksgiving dinner with some friends on Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, and there the woman's, I think maybe great aunt, and one of her another aunt and uncle were there, and there was this big bowl of mashed parsnips made, nobody ate it. And so at some point, I don't like mashed parsnips. I mean, if I was at someone's house and they gave me a helping, I would eat them. But we asked about that, and they said, well, nobody likes them, but it's traditional. We have to have them on there. They have to be there for Thanksgiving, even though nobody likes them. They're a marker. And, you know, there aren't very many households for whom anything but turkey, I mean, other than vegetarian friends that I know, or Native Alaskan friends for whom crane seems like a good substitute.
But even where turkey isn't served, there is vegetarian friends of ours will strive to have some of the symbolic foods associated with Thanksgiving, yams or pumpkin or cranberries, some of those things that are associated with the festival meal.
Do you suppose the mashed parsnips were a sign of plentitude? I mean, we didn't have to eat them, but we had them, and that's what Thanksgiving is this honoring of our plenitude, of our harvest brought in well.
I think you're asking an interesting question here about how conscious we are of the meanings of our traditions.
Mm.
I don't think that the people who said we always have them thought of them as being a symbol of plenitude. We can stand back and say perhaps that's what they were.
It was sort of presented as with the idea that, there used to be someone in the family who like to eat mashed parsnips, but, you know, they're long gone.
We remember Maud.
Right.
Well, I think it goes back to the idea that ritual is ritual because it's repeated and has certain features that are always there. And if those
the bottom line for most people about ritual is, this is the way we've always done it. And so, I mean,
and so even if something happens that is not the way you've always done it, you find a way to make it the way you've always done it. Another little interesting example that I came up with the other day, that I read about the other day, was of a Pentecostal church service in Bermuda, where a man who was extremely drunk was acting pretty disruptive to the service. And here we had a situation where there was a ritual underway, and people had a variety of possibilities for responding to this disruption. They could, you know, escort the man out, or they could stop the service, or they could be upset about it. In fact, what they did was they incorporated it right into the service, and they converted him, and they brought him up. And as, in fact, he was coming up to the front of the room, he threw up copiously. Now, people both recognized being disgusted by that and also turned it into a symbol of what was going on, which was that he was expelling Satan.
This is the devil was being cast out of
him. The devil was being cast out of him. The interesting thing about this particular case, too, is that later on when the man was sober, he said, yes, he had been saved. So ritual has this, people have this ability through ritual of both putting the mashed parsnips on the table, that is, taking something and whether or not it has any overt meaning to them, repeating it because that's a necessary part of the ritual, and taking new things and finding a way to incorporate them into the meaning of the ritual.
Now, going from there, I'm very interested in the pressure the Catholic Church is under in the last couple of decades, and I expect, again, the next couple of decades. It has liberation theology saying, mm-hmm. you're not fulfilling Catholicism for us.
You're not
us.
Meeting the needs of the poor at all.
Civil rights movements around the world are saying the same thing to the Catholic Church. The women's movement has said it. The fight in its own way between pro-choice and pro-life movements are talking loudly to the Catholic Church. And that organization has bent and changed to the people before. What are your thoughts on when the people change the institution?
Well, I'm not going to give a prognosis on the Catholic Church, but certainly, historically, those have been the kinds of issues that have caused divisions and new sects and new churches to arise. And
this is a church that doesn't easily accept the drunken church, where the Pentecostal group you described in Bermuda could accept him in and work him into the ritual.
Although we certainly, as you said, there are a lot of practicing Catholics who are changing ritual somewhat and changing the interpretations of rituals in order to incorporate their sense of what is socially just. So there is variation. I mean, when we look back at the folk song Mass of the 1960s, that was quite a departure. And when we look at the change from Latin to mm-hmm. English, that was an amazing departure from the Church's original stand on things. So
but
the
if,
Church has
But if
some
we look at that stand, I mean, I may be wrong in this, but I think that one of Martin Luther's main points was that to have services in the local language, in that case German. So that change has occurred, but it's taken 400 years.
And when someone tried to make it occur 400 years ago, it caused a great schism.
So things change, but certainly entrenched bureaucratic structures change slowly.
Do you see signs in this culture, which recognizes itself as fairly traditionless, of changing traditions as we move along?
Well, one of the things that I don't know whether this directly relates or not, but thinking about the number of people I know in Alaska who are virtually familyless in terms of no cousins, no nieces, no nephews, you know, their own immediate family, a partner if they have one, children if they have one. That isn't true for everyone, but for an awful lot of people, that's true.
We have a large immigrant Alaskan population from the lower 48.
Yeah, and we're talking here non-Native people. People have sort of talked to me explicitly about trying to do things with their friend, with their network of friends, trying to sort of create family. So, in a somewhat conscious effort.
And creating family traditions over time,
I think. Right. Meeting together with the same people, if possible, for holidays and doing certain things together.
Right. And certain people, you know, so maybe instead of Aunt Emmy, who in my family, for instance, always brought a dish that was made of Jell-O and whipped cream and nuts, and it had various fruit in it. I mean, it was always kind of red, and Phyllis never liked it. I'm sure she still brings it. I haven't had Thanksgiving with her in a while. Then maybe instead of that, Ralph would bring, you know, whatever he, guacamole and chips, you know, that over time. The first time it happens, it's not a tradition, but, you know,
if it's repeated and if it becomes expected and if it somehow is wrong, if Ralph doesn't bring the guacamole,
like if Ralph was sick or was flying in really late, you know, then maybe like someone else would get the ingredients for him so that he could do that. That was his dish.
What else on this subject interests the two of you?
I almost feel like we have to take a different left turn.
All right.
Which is that I think that in your program guide you said something about why is a zombie a zombie?
I was thinking about zombies.
And we never got to that.
Yeah.
And maybe we should
talk about zombies a little bit.
We should talk about the creation of popular images. We're diverting a little bit from the idea of rituals and customs, but we are talking about a folklore process, and those folkloristic images are also symbolic and important in their symbolic meaning. So we are still connected here. But Chase, you were
sure. There's a
take this one.
What's his last name? Wade Davis. Book called the Serpent in the Rainbow, which talks about. Well, let me back up. He was an ethnobotanist, somebody who studies the native use of plants, and a graduate student at Harvard. And an actual zombie had been found in Haiti. Now, let's back up and say that the Haitians for a long time, a lot of Haitians had said, of course there are zombies. But Western medicine had never accepted that. That had never been scientifically accepted.
The idea of the living dead.
The idea of the living dead or of someone dying and coming back to life. Because... There weren't any good death certificates. So how did you know that someone was really dead, you know, if they didn't come back? But this was somebody who'd been declared dead by an American doctor, and 16 years later he came back. And
was positively identified.
There was no doubt that this guy had died, certified dead, and been buried. And 16 years later, here he was, you know. So Wade Davis went off to see what was going on. Now, he had various ideas. He thought that perhaps something was being done of drugging people who were going to be zombies with Datura, a common Jimson weed is another name. It's a common Western plant in the Western United States that poisons cattle often, but it's used shamanically as a drug to
it's
induce.
A hallucinogenic.
It's a very strong hallucinogen, long-lasting effects. It's a sort of drug where maybe seven seeds are a dose that gives you visions and 12 kills you. And in Haiti, the one kind of Datura, the seed pods of it are called the zombie's cucumber. So that was his first guess. But basically what he found out was that, yes, there were zombies. Zombies were created. There was a mechanism for creating zombies, and it was a form of social control.
By the way, the formula that was used was a combination of actual
natural drugs
and magical
drugs.
Drugs.
Although we need to back up here and say that we're calling magical because we haven't been able to find any pharmacological effects from them, and we can't think of anything else that they might be doing. And certainly, you know, ground bones doesn't seem like that's a likely constitute of an effective poison. Some of the other the main infective ingredient was ground up puffer fish skin, which actually quite a bit was known about the effects of that, because it's the same, it's closely related to a fish called fugu that the Japanese eat. And there's a famous short poem about fugu which says, "Those who eat fugu are crazy. Those who do not eat fugu are also crazy." If it's properly prepared, then you get a sublethal dose, and you just get a kind of high and a slight tingling in your limbs. And if it's improperly prepared, or you eat too much of it, then you die. Or at least, there are cases in Japan where they thought someone was dead, but it took a long time to ship the body home. And
and it turned out that they were still alive, which was a great clue for Haiti.
What it turns out is that the poison in this fish just vastly slows down all bodily functions. So respiration goes down to one or two breaths a minute. Heartbeat's imperceptible. The pupils don't contract. The person sure seems dead. What appears to have happened is that in Haiti there are, it's stronger than clubs, groups, which you, secret societies, shall we say, which you join, and if a member of your family, and it seemed like the infractions were primarily someone cheating someone else out of land, and you feel that you've been have been wrongfully done by some member of your family, then it's like the extreme sanction. You sell them to one of these, for a certain sum of money, to one of these secret societies. And then that person is judged before a tribunal. And if they're found guilty, then at some point later, they're made into a zombie. They're poisoned with this material sometime when they're not suspecting it, and they die for all intents and purposes.
And their personal experiences, of course, of dying and then of being, of
coming
back. Well,
actually, they say that people talk about not losing consciousness in that period of being buried alive, but of being, okay, let's back up for a second. The timing has to work out just right. Let's say, Susan, that, you know, you're poisoned in the morning and you're buried, they might very well bury you that night because it's a hot country and we're not talking about embalming. People go bad. Maybe they're unable to dig you up until the poison effects have begun to wear off. Part of what we think of classically as zombies is people whose brains have been oxygen starved for a while tend to lose their, have a sort of shuffling gait and slow speech, and they're not very bright anymore. Mentally impaired. Certainly some of the rep for zombies was of people not being dug up in time. But also, apparently, when they would dig up a zombie, they would then give him or her a really strong dose of drugs, including hallucinogens. So, and that, like Datura, the zombies.
Keep them in thrall, literally.
Keep them in thrall, literally, and take them, they would be taken off to someplace else on the island and kept on a steady diet of mind-numbing local drugs, pharmaceuticals. Plants, and worked as a slave labor.
So now we come to our image of the zombie, and we have to say that the children who are pretending to be zombies on Halloween are in no way except in terms of the image of the slow-moving
sort of stumbling gait, arms out
zombie. What is their connection with this tradition? Well,
Hollywood.
It's Hollywood, and I think we would be doing Halloween a terrible injustice to say that now that we know how zombies are used as slaves were used as slaves in Haiti, and what a terrible thing, from a Western perspective, this is, and so on, that therefore we should never let children dress up as zombies on Halloween. That would be making a great mistake. It's assuming that that historical meaning is present in some conscious way, or if not in a conscious way, in some way that's important for us to recognize and eradicate.
Embodied in the costume.
Mm-hmm.
Embodied
mm-hmm.
in the custom in this case. Can I have some details about zombies? If you have stolen land from your brother, when you are tried, are you aware that you're being tried?
Mm, yes.
You know that you're found guilty and going to become a zombie?
Well, no, you don't know. I think you're not told what the results are. But you may very well leave at that point.
We're not, by the way, not talking about vast numbers of people in Haiti being conscripted as zombies. I think it's important to point this out.
I'm kind of interested in the aspect of social control, though.
Right. That's why I brought that up, because obviously there are methods of social control that work before zombieism is invoked, and the threat of zombieism in itself would keep a lot of people
from treating their families that way. So, it operates as a
deterrent.
And it's another thing that's really clear about why it took a long time for this practice to. Oh, there's something else I want to come back to about Africa. For this practice to come to light is that if your family has essentially made the living dead out of you, then you're not going to be very anxious to go home again, even if you do kind of get brain clear, even if you weren't brain damaged in the process, and at some point you you get in a clear enough mind to escape from wherever you're being held as slave labor.
You can't go back to the family that sold you.
Right. You're going to figure that you're at risk, yeah. Right? The other thing that Wade Davis talked about in this book that was real interesting is how this may very well be certainly the secret societies have strong connections with the African roots of a particular part of Africa where a lot of the slaves who made up early population of Haiti came from. And there's a lot of knowledge of poison to various points in Africa. So it wasn't a connection that was made completely, but certainly is an interesting speculation that that this may be a continuation
of that knowledge.
And particularly for people enslaved and then Haiti was the only country in which there was a successful slave revolt in 1802. They threw the French out. And so, but then there were a succession of black governments in Haiti, but power was still very much from the top down, and so this was a way. I mean, the reason the secret societies were secret is because they didn't have
legitimized power.
Right. They had secret power.
And there's been some argument about this subaltern society or groups of societies in Haiti that they actually provide the structure and the security for a society that has only imposed dictatorial structure and a very insecure economic and social structure.
Right.
So in some ways, perhaps a child would want to dress up as a zombie if the child was a child of revolutionaries.
Because it would represent this kind of rebellion. It truly fits in with the idea of Halloween as a ritual of reversal.
We found the true meaning of Halloween. It's a revolutionary day.
It's not anti-religious, just anti-governmental.
That's right. Phyllis Morrow and Chase Hensel, I want to thank you for spending an hour in conversations. It's been wide-reaching and very interesting.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. An hour with anthropologists about traditions, customs, and costumes. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you'll join me again next week on Conversations.